The assignment here is Biblical Perspective on Persecution. This is our third session on it. In our first session, almost the first thing out of my mouth was, why would anybody want to persecute nice people like you? And we saw that it's because of the truth. It's because of what you stand for, and especially the fact that you speak the truth. Truth by itself wouldn't do it, but speaking the truth. And I made the point that if Peter and John hadn't spoken the truth that they knew, nothing would have happened to them. And we're still getting toward the book of Acts, but I first wanted us to see that persecution doesn't necessarily happen long ago and far away on the other side of the world only. It has always happened in certain environments. Was I supposed to do anything? You didn't want me to wear that tonight? Okay, this is all right. So I leave this on? Okay. Thank you. Sorry I didn't notice it first. Last time I lost track of the time toward the end and had to stop rather abruptly, so I didn't get to say what I should have said, and Dan Turner stood up and said it for me. So I appreciated that very much. He said, don't let it get you down. And there are always dark and light threads through anything. We happened to be on a dark thread last week and didn't get out of it because I forgot what time it was. But there are light threads with regard to this subject too. So I appreciated him saying, don't let it get you down. What we were talking about, I think, was the technological ability that we now have to exercise virtually complete control of surveillance and every other aspect of life. And there are forces at work that not only want to control you, but also would like to humiliate and even break you. So that's the issue at stake here. Human nature has not changed. The only thing that changes it is the Lord Jesus Christ. You are partakers of the divine nature, but you're in a minority. So as the church and as individuals, we speak the truth in love. And that is breaking the rules of the game when you have a regime of lies. And totalitarianism always is a regime of lies. So by breaking the rules of the game, we expose it as a mere game. We shatter the world of appearances, which are really the main pillar of the system. In other words, you and I are the ones who say that the emperor has no clothes. And everybody who steps out of line in this matter threatens the entire system. Therefore, people who live only for their own comfort and survival are willing to live with lies to protect that, but they are demoralized people. And that system depends on this kind of demoralization. I hate to really, in one sense, I hate to keep referring back to Orwell, but it's just so pertinent all the way through that novel. Winston Smith, the protagonist of the novel, had it insisted to him that 2 + 2 = 5. He said, no, 2 + 2 = 4. And he wouldn't say anything different than 4 for a long time. But when they gave him enough drugs and enough torture, eventually he agreed that 2 + 2 = 5. A completely demoralized man. We need to make up our minds now that to compromise for the sake of lies, or with the lies for the sake of a peaceful life, is to bend the knee to death. You and I may need to learn to live with reduced expectations of worldly success, but always to remember that truth outweighs the whole world. So we defend the truth and we endure the consequences. And there may come a point, and as I said before, I don't know what's going to happen, but there may well come a point where you have to decide whether a broken body is a price worth paying for an undefiled spirit. They may label you mentally ill. They may give you electroshock therapy or something worse. But there's a showdown that comes in times like we're talking about. And yes, we do need to assess which fights are worth having. We don't have to have every fight every day. You can pick your battles. And no, prudence is not the same thing as cowardice, but if you cannot imagine any situation where you would stand up and speak the truth and let the chips fall where they will, then cowardice has a greater claim on you than it should. because this political religion that murdered 100 million people in the last century and imprisoned and tortured countless more and made miserable the lives of half of humanity in its time is being romanticized by ignorant young skulls full of mush in our time. The political religion leads to a falsification of history, and it creates suckers for the false utopian promises. Not to know what happened before you were born is to remain a child forever. And this is the case with more people than not. In 1984, again, remember, the job of the protagonist was to erase all newspaper records of past events. Why? Because the state kept changing its mind as things changed. So you had to go change the newspaper record so that the state could not be shown to be contradictory. So they had to be re-erased and say maybe the opposite of what you put in last month, but they had to be re-erased again so that when people went to those newspapers, oh yeah, it's always been this way. The great ambition of totalitarianism is the total control of human memory. And this is achieved through a total state monopoly on information, including education and media. Because a person cut off from real history is almost powerless against power. You know, in the Soviet Union, they killed people who could remember history, and that made it easier to create a false history. So where does the church fit into all this? The Lord has built the church as a community that keeps on telling the truth no matter what. Internally, externally, here, there, and everywhere, we speak the truth in love. The church is a space where the true, real meaning of words is preserved. The church is a space where we describe reality as it really is. The church is a place where we show people what a normal, monogamous family looks like. Family is the place where we first learn to love other people. Family is the bedrock of civilization, and the church is God's family. The church is God's family. I remember when Brenda started bringing Jim Smith around. This was over at Gregory Boulevard, long before we started here at Smart Road, but over at Gregory Boulevard, I don't know if Jim remembers what he said or not, but after he'd been there a time or two, and Brenda was talking about the church, Jim said, "Brenda, that's not a church, that's a family." Because of the way he saw people relating to each other. It's not like many so-called churches are. We have these relationships so that people with deficient nuclear families can come here and still have God's family with all the benefits and blessings of that. Maybe your own family has deteriorated, but you still have God's family, and you have role models, and you have extra grandmas and grandpas and fathers and mothers. If and when we have a full-fledged government and social order that's bent on the destruction of the family because they see the family and the church as threats to state control, then it's very important to keep ourselves grounded in reality. That's probably more important even than winning an argument, is just keeping grounded in reality. Because totalitarianism, if it comes to us, is going to insist on the abandonment of reason. We talked about that especially in our first session. The loss of tradition, the loss of memory. And it's going to push politics into the faith and thinking of the individual if it possibly can. And if possible, the function of the family will be reduced to producing autonomous consumers with no sense of connection, no sense of obligation to do anything greater than fulfill their own desires. And by the way, when we mindlessly surrender our children's minds to smartphones and the internet, we play right into this already. We should reject the worshiping of children and reject the catering to their every desire. Also, the modern family should, it just will not hold together if the father and mother consider divorce as an easy solution to the difficulties of marriage. I believe the key is the Christian father. A Christian father must above all be a servant of Christ and be aware that his family does not exist only for itself, but first for God. So while we teach our children how to read the Bible, we also teach our children how to read the world around them. how to understand people and events in terms of right and wrong. And we must give them opportunities to serve something greater than themselves and expose them to things that help them to know the difference between truth and falsehood. Vaccinate them against lies. And this can start very early. I remember with Amber when she was just very, very young, barely able to walk. There'd come a commercial on TV and it would be intriguing and interesting. And I said, well, you know, they really just want our money. And it wasn't long before she was saying the same thing. They just want our money. It doesn't take long to learn that. And it's true. And show them that it's okay to be different. Teach them that there is a good God who will eventually win, though we may not see it during our lifetimes. Teach them that suffering is not meaningless because we are part of a greater battle. Teach them what to live for. Teach them that they are accountable to God. I stress this because I do believe that the demands on us will grow greater, and the consequences for failing to submit to the system will grow more severe. And the reason for that is that the Christian faith is a rival religion that the post-Christian world won't tolerate for long. Totalitarianism will always try to break down the family and the church because it's in the family and the church that you get the strength to be able to fight. The church is a survival strategy for the faith in times of persecution. We help one another have the courage that we all need. It's interesting how sometimes when you see a person behaving courageously, you act a little more courageously yourself. The willingness of the martyrs to suffer, even unto death, always plants the love for God into the hearts of the people who see it, the people at least of a certain mindset. This is why Tertullian said, he was reporting history, that the blood of the martyrs became the seed of the church. That's become a truism. It's been quoted so often, but often truisms are truisms because they happen to be true. The blood of the martyrs became the seed of the church. If you suffer for truth, that somehow seems to make truth more credible to other people. The Lord taught us that if we share in his suffering here, we'll share in his glory in the next world. So each of us faces the private question, which is going to win in you, faith or fear? Fear or courage? Are you just an admirer of Jesus Christ, or are you a true disciple of Christ? Jesus didn't proclaim a philosophy. He proclaimed a way of life which was the life of the way. And his whole life was calculated. All of his teaching was calculated to have followers and to make admirers impossible. The Lord gives you a reason to die, which is to say, a reason to live. There can be nothing more beautiful than to lay down your life for God. So each of us needs to be ready to die, because only then will we have the strength to resist the lies. If we have the right approach, we can receive whatever our interrogators dish out to us, and we can receive it as an aid to our own salvation. And the scriptures that you have in your memory will be a wonderful aid when you are behind bars, if that time comes. The scriptures in your mind will help you order the time and maintain a sanity, and that is especially true if you're placed in solitary confinement. If your soul is free, they're limited in what they can do to you. And generally in these situations, those who are afraid end up worse off than those who are courageous. So like Bonhoeffer said, and like Jesus said before him, we need to count the cost of discipleship. This is doable, no matter what happens. It's been done before. Stalin took the leaders of the churches and imprisoned them, and what happened? Other men stood up to fill their shoes. So Stalin took their meeting houses. And what happened? People who lived close to one another gathered in small groups in their homes. They read the Bible and prayed and sang together. 60 years of terror, and they were unable to get rid of faith. And when the Bibles were confiscated, people rewrote what they could remember by hand and passed it clandestinely amongst themselves. There were little niches of freedom in a godless world. There was camaraderie in the midst of travail. When you join your grief to the grief of others, it's easier to carry. And in worshiping God with the church, we find something to draw us out of ourselves into something bigger. Yes, it's true that in these times, trusting the wrong person can land you in prison. That happens. And sometimes even the entire welfare of a whole congregation can be at stake. And yet we can't overly worry in those times about who's a government agent and who is not. This is always an issue. It was an issue in the first century. We have it right in the book of Acts. Here came the Apostle Paul. He tries to place his membership with the church at Jerusalem, but they're not having it. We know who you are. Get out of here. We know your record. We know exactly what you're trying to do. They didn't trust him. Can you blame them? I don't blame them. Not one bit. If Barnabas hadn't stood up for him, they probably never would have accepted him. And we may face situations that are somewhat like that. But if we get too paranoid about who's a government agent and who isn't, we'll tear ourselves apart as a community of saints. So I wouldn't worry too much, not unduly, about that, because with the surveillance ability they've got now, you're going to be constantly observed by the secret police anyway if this thing happens. They'll park right in front of your house, and they'll sit there. And all I know to tell you is, if it's cold outside, invite them in for a cup of coffee. Do good to them that hate you. That's what the Lord taught us. He knows what works best. Always behave as you believe Christ would behave. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and curse not. Part of our problem is that the great lie in our therapeutic culture is that personal happiness is the greatest good of all. That is so widely believed that it makes its way into our consciousness, that personal happiness is the greatest good of all, that that's the goal. Oh, I just want my children to be happy. I just want them to be happy. Is that really your goal? Because our goal ought to be that we want them to be faithful. I want my children to be faithful. Happiness is secondary or tertiary or somewhere down the line. The truth is that suffering is a normal part of life, even in the best of times. The truth is that suffering teaches us how to be patient and kind and loving. Get to the place where you can offer your pain as a gift to God. Go through it if it comes, so that you can help other people and help the church. Remembering that God gave you everything you have, God gave you everything you've enjoyed all these years. And if it gets taken away, if the going gets rough, are you going to pretend that you don't believe? That's the question you have to face. And we each face it individually, and we'll each decide it individually if things come crashing down. There is nothing requiring us to seek out suffering. We're not masochists, after all. But suffering, if it does come, and it's unavoidable to faithful people at times, it can be rightly received as a gift. In the Gulag Archipelago, Alexander Solzhenitsyn urged us to have mercy on prisoners who broke under torture. Sometimes people will say anything just to make the pain stop. And if you think you won't, just let them bring in one of your granddaughters and torture her in front of you and see what you might be liable to say to make it stop. None of us really knows. To forgive and not curse your torturer and not consider anything of this world to be a treasure to you, that's Christian maturity. And the light thread here, since we've painted this dark thread again, the light thread is that some of these people who experienced these prisons under these circumstances we're talking about had great moments of joy. Moments of joy like they said they had never reached in freedom. Here they had everything stripped away from them except their faith in God. And in prison, they found an inner liberation through suffering. They had moments that some of them described as being like paradise. It seemed that the less they were able to change the world around them, the stronger they became. They even changed their understanding of what true freedom is. And accepting suffering was the beginning of their liberation. One man even went so far as to say, "Suffering was a gift from God that invited me to change. Suffering started my revolution against the greatest totalitarian ruler of all, myself." To me, that's a striking statement. That's an amazing place to get to in life. Suffering started my revolution against the greatest totalitarian ruler of all, myself. Yes, the price of freedom is eternal vigilance, but that vigilance is first of all over your own hearts. There is no Christian faith without tears. Truth cannot be separated from tears. Feeble forms of faith will quickly burn away in the face of persecution. What we will be in the time of testing depends in part on what we are today. As I said last week, all of us would prefer that this cup of suffering pass from us. But if our moment comes, we need to be ready to make a costly stand. We won't know how to behave when the time arrives if we haven't prepared ourselves to accept pain and loss for the sake of the Lord. So we need to learn the accounts of Christian martyrdom so we'll know when and how to live them. Our suffering will have purpose, even though the purpose may not be very clear to us at the time. But it can serve as a refiner's fire and, as somebody called it, a severe mercy. Persecution is just an intrinsic part of the Christian picture, and it always has been. It always has been. The fact that we haven't faced it personally does not change the reality of the Christian faith in general through the years. The example of the apostles as they handled persecution is a blessing to all of us. And in the first three centuries, there were 10 major waves of Roman persecution against the church. I think you know that Nero contrived all kinds of punishments for Christians. He would sew some of them up in the skins of wild animals and then turn dogs loose on them, hungry dogs. He used others dressed in wax shirts and attached them to trees to be lit as torches to light his garden. The next persecution under Domitian was even more inventive. Christians were put on racks, they were boiled, they were broiled, they were burned, scourged, stoned, hanged, lacerated with hot irons, thrown on the horns of wild bulls. In the fourth persecution under Marcus Aurelius, some Christians were made to walk with already wounded feet over thorns, nails, sharp shells. Some were scourged until the flesh was completely gone. Others were beheaded, and so it went. In the eighth persecution under Valerian, 300 Christians were placed around a lime kiln and told that they were to make offerings to Jupiter or be pushed into the lime kiln. Unanimously, they refused to make offerings to Jupiter, and all 300 of them perished in the lime. This is only the beginning of what the church has undergone. We don't even have recorded much of what happened. But even before these that I've described by the Romans, several times in the very first few years of the church, hands were stretched forth to persecute it on an organized basis, until persecution became such a normal thing that some of the Christians developed a martyr complex where they actually tried to put themselves into positions where they would be martyred. They became known as the gamblers, and the elders of the congregations would have to get up and say, "Now, don't everybody get killed this week. Don't seek this out. We need to meet next week, too." They were advised not to seek to die for the cause. Jesus had warned his disciples that they should expect persecution. John 15:18 is one place. "If the world hates you, know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own." John says, "Love not the world." Why? Because when a Christian falls in love with the system is no longer hindered by him or her. But he says, Jesus says, you're not of the world, but I have chosen you out of the world. Therefore, the world hates you. And in verse 20 of John 15, remember the word that I said unto you, the servant is not greater than his Lord. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. John 16, verse 2. They'll put you out of their synagogues. The time will come when whosoever kills you will think that he does God service. They very well may be that the people who persecute you, if that time comes, will think they're doing exactly the right thing. So the Apostle Peter said in 1 Peter 2:21, hereunto were you called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that we should follow in his steps. And again, 2 Timothy 3, verse 12. Yea, all that live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. If you live as God intends you to live, you will butt heads with the system at some point. When Paul wrote that, the persecution they were facing was very serious. As I told you last week, I believe that the intent of the assignment I've been given is to talk about the serious side of persecution, imprisonment or worse. I wouldn't say that we shouldn't use the word persecution for the milder forms, but the ones we really need to be prepared to face are the more serious forms. Acts chapter 4 records the first of these persecutions after the establishment of the church. Everybody here, I think, is aware that the church was established on the day of Pentecost, as recorded in the second chapter of the book of Acts. And in chapters 2 and 3, things look pretty positive. The church found favor with the people. Why wouldn't they? They're a bunch of nice people. But as it became clear what they stood for, the gears shifted pretty fast. Confrontation brought hostility. In chapter 3, Peter and John went to the temple at the afternoon hour of prayer, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Peter healed a lame man. This caused a crowd to gather. Peter preached Jesus as the Messiah. He indicted Israel for executing Christ. He closed with an invitation to repent and be converted in verse 19. He confronted the world he was in. If I'm not willing to confront the world for the sake of their salvation, then I have nothing to offer to God or to the world. Chapter 4, verse 4 says that enough believed, based on this, that the number of the men in the church came up to 5,000. 3,000 in chapter 2 came up to 5,000, inclusively, in chapter 4. And the word there is the word meaning male as opposed to female, so there were probably thousands more women when we add them in, and there would be many children meeting with the saints as well. We never have another listing of a number with regard to how many there were from here on, probably because it was growing so fast it was difficult for them to keep an accurate count. But in chapter 4, verse 1, we see the flashpoint. While they were speaking to the people, this is Peter and John speaking to the people, this is after the healing of the lame man when the crowd was gathered. While they were speaking to the people, the priest and the captain of the temple and the Sadducees came upon them. They came upon them with anxiety. They came upon them with anger to arrest them. Peter was already wrapping up what he was saying, and they grabbed Peter and John. The priests were there. The priests were supposed to represent the people. Most of the priests lived places other than Jerusalem. And this shows where the priesthood has gone as far as from God as could be imagined almost, far from what God intended. There were 24 courses of priests. They lived all over the country. They served at the temple by rotating courses. So you waited a long time. If you were a priest, you waited a long time for your week, and when it came, it was a big deal. And you didn't want a commotion like this going on during your week that you'd waited so long for. So the priest came out here to deal with it. The captain of the temple was also there. He was the head of the temple police. The Roman government was pretty tolerant of a lot of things, but against public disorder, they were merciless. So the head of the temple police didn't want a riot, or he'd be in big trouble. The Sadducees were also there. They were the sect with the most power in Israel at the time. The Sadducees were the high priestly family. The Sadducees were, of course, the opposition party to the Pharisees. And it's interesting, we have Pharisees and Sadducees quite a lot in the New Testament, but it changes from the Gospels to the book of Acts. The opposition of the Pharisees to Jesus dominates the Gospels, but the opposition of the Sadducees to the church dominates the book of Acts. These Sadducees were extremely wealthy. They were collaborationists with Rome for mutual back scratching. They didn't really care much for the common people, though they pretended to. They cared about maintaining the status quo. That was their main goal, keeping their power and prestige in Israel. It's a hallmark of the human personality that when people have power, they tend to want to keep it, and that was the case here. The Sadducees were a very small group, very minority, but they kept on friendly terms with Rome, and that was part of their power. They really didn't care very much about religion except for keeping the social customs going, the things that everybody could see. They were big into how things appeared, much more than how things really were. They accepted only the books of Moses, but none of the rabbinical laws that the Pharisees lived and died by. The Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection of the body, nor future reward, nor punishment, nor angels or spirits. They believed primarily that man is the master of his own fate and that God was not involved with humanity very much at all. So these are the VIP blue bloods of Jerusalem, and they come after Peter and John. And the reasons they did it are in verse 2. Being grieved that they taught the people and preached through Jesus the resurrection from the dead. First of all, they were just grieved that they taught at all. The word for grieved means that they were in pain. They were in terrible mental anguish over this. It's an anguish that's based on indignation and wrath. It's used again in Acts 16, verse 18, where Paul saw the girl at Philippi under the power of an evil spirit, and Paul had the same attitude about that the Sadducees had about this. It's angry indignation. Why were they angry? That Peter and John taught the people, because the Sadducees believed that they had the corner on truth and that anything else was very suspect. They believed they had the right to teach and nobody else did, least of all, did they have the right to just walk right into the temple compound and do it there? Who were they to teach? They were not approved. So verse 13 says, when they saw the boldness of Peter and John, they perceived that they were unlearned and ignorant men. They're not versed in our theology. They haven't been to our schools. How can they know anything? Of course, they had said the same thing about Jesus. This man is not yet 50 years old. Where is he getting all this stuff from? Who is he that's saying all this? He's never been to our school. Or is he getting his information? And Jesus, of course, said, well, I get it directly from God, so school is a little extraneous. Ignorant means that they're strictly common amateurs. And to make it worse, Peter and John were from Galilee, which meant they were in the basket of deplorables. So it bothered the Sadducees that the apostles taught at all. But it also bothered them what they taught. They preached through Jesus the resurrection from the dead. And that they hated. They didn't believe in it. They didn't want other people believing in it. They had argued with the Pharisees about it for years. And the Pharisees, there were more of them than there were Sadducees. They had determined that Jesus was a blasphemer, and they thought they had just gotten rid of it. And now here his followers are announcing publicly that Jesus is the Messiah and you've killed your Messiah. And not only that, but they're announcing that Jesus is alive. And that's scary. If they killed him to get rid of him and he's back again, that's a fearful thought. Because if he really is back again, what's going to hinder him from bringing vengeance that they so justly deserved? They knew they were hypocrites. And that's where part of the fear came from. They knew that their power was maintained only by the people's submission to the system. So they needed very quickly to shut these guys. I don't know whether to say shut them up or shut them down. I'll say both. Shut them up and shut them down. That was necessary. So verse 3, they laid hands on them and not to appoint them to office. They put them in custody in jail until the next day, for now it was eventide. Peter and John had come to the temple compound at 3 in the afternoon for the prayers, and they've healed the lame man. They've had a lot of conversation, and Peter has spoken. By this time, it's at least 6 o'clock, which is sundown. And in a world lit only by fire, they didn't do much at night. Verse 4, many of them who heard the word believed, and the number of the males came to be 5,000. This shows that imprisoning the apostles did not nullify their effect. Just the opposite is true. It did not prevent the progress of the gospel. This was the first instance, which has so often been repeated, in which persecution has only led to the extension of the church. Peter and John were leading by example here. And example is such an important thing. Example is important in things large and small. This isn't analogous at all, but it comes to mind. After we had last year 15 days to flatten the curve and then 30 days to flatten the curve, and we weren't supposed to assemble, and most of us hadn't because we wanted to work with that. I think people's hearts were in the right place on all sides of that. But when that was over and things were still kind of up in the air, at some point, I heard, and I didn't hear him say this myself specifically, but I heard that one of my elders, Bill Norman, if you know Bill Norman, here is the most mild-mannered of men. Doesn't say much. So when he does say something, you know it's important. I heard that one of my elders had just had enough of not meeting with the church and finally said, well, put me in jail if you want to, but I'm going to church. And when I heard that he said that, I was sorely tempted to be proud of him. Even though I don't believe in pride as a way to go, but that's a leader, you know. Leaders lead. And Peter and John were leading here. They were setting an example. As the church is persecuted, it is purified. As the church pays the price of discipleship, the tares drop away. And I said last week at the end, don't assume that you know who's a tare and who's weak. You might be surprised. Some little old lady that comes and doesn't say much and sits off by herself and just comes and goes and takes care of her life, she might turn out to be the strongest one in the congregation. And somebody that gets up and teaches you how to deal with persecution might flack off and go over the hill. You never know about these things. The arm of flesh will fail you. It's just a matter of time. Every human idol you make will always turn out to have feet of clay. So count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Thank you. Count it all joy when you fall into various trials. That's the way you grow, by going through the test. In reacting to persecution, be submissive to it. Not submissive to the lies of the system, but be submissive to the persecution itself. That's what Peter and John teach us here. Do we read that Peter and John hit back and that a riot ensued? We see no resistance from them at all. We see no indication that they struggled against their captors or fought against the detention. And this is a notable lack of resistance, especially from Peter, who just weeks earlier had lopped off the ear of the high priest's servant in a misguided attempt to protect Jesus from arrest. Here we find a pattern through the book of faithfully submitting to wicked authorities and their unjust punishments, because the brethren saw it as an opportunity for God. They knew that their obedience had brought them to this point, so they were submissive to the arrest. In Gerald's talk about preparation for persecution, he said, don't be surprised when it comes. Don't be surprised. Exactly the same thing the Apostle Peter said. Think it not strange. Think it not strange. And the next day they brought them to the Sanhedrin. And this is the Supreme Court of the Jews. Even in Roman times, they had the right to arrest. There were 70 members, plus the high priest was president, so there were 71. Verse 6 introduces Annas. We'll go into that a little bit more next time when we take this up, just to paint the picture. But my main point about this encounter is that there was no way the apostles could have set this up without this persecution. To be able to talk to the Sanhedrin Council of the Jews, how could they have set it up? Could Peter have called the Sanhedrin and said, now John and I would like to come over and talk with you guys. Would Tuesday work or would Thursday be better for you? They would have never gotten to first base that way. This is the only way. They submitted and God put them right where he wanted them. And now it's the Sanhedrin's idea. And the Sanhedrin is more than inviting them. The Sanhedrin is insisting that they speak. What happened? Satan and his opposition has overreached himself again, just as he did when he killed Jesus and set up the resurrection. Satan is not omniscient. He does not know what's going to happen. God is omniscient. He knows what's going to happen, and Satan overreaches himself again and again. And once the Sanhedrin get them in there, they ask them the right question. By what power or by what name have you done this? And the Greek there indicates that they kept on asking. Come on, tell us. And Peter may have been demurring a little bit, like he didn't want to talk. He couldn't wait to talk. So it's time to stop. We'll, Lord willing, pick it up there next week and take examples as time allows.